Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Lori Fatchett McGee, who's serving as our worship associate, our music director, Hal Walker, and some wonderful musicians who have some beautiful songs to share with us today. The element of fire represents passion, veracity, authenticity, and vitality. If the chalice is the supporting structure of Unitarian Universalism, then we are the flame. We are the flame, fanned strong by our passions for freedom, our yearning for truth-telling, and our daring to be authentic with one another, and in the vitality we sustain in our meeting together.
You can be the tree. Don't be the raindrop if you can be the sea.
But the leaf may fall, but the tree remains. It may never at all, but the sea remains.
Better to be the tree and the sea.
See?
Don't be a cloud if you can be the sky. Don't be a feather, be a bird and fly. Clouds roll away, the sky rolls on.
Without a lining is still a coat. Better to be the boat and the coat.
Quote.
Don't be the stick if you can't be the drum. Don't be the sugar, be the plum. By God, you can break a stick, but the drum will be without a sugar coat. Plums are good to eat. Better to be the drum and the plum and the coat and the boat and the bird and the sky and the tree and the deep blue sea.
Well, if we all had the performance ability of those two young ladies. Goodness. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, "Sit here, eat." You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. Come, let us worship together. Once upon a time, a kitten was born. He was a ragdoll cat, which is a very special breed of cat. Ragdoll cats have beautiful, long, luxurious fur. They are also famous for being the most mellow cats in the entire universe. These cats pretty much spend their days snoozing in the sun, snacking on dainty treats, and making sure their fur looks absolutely fabulous all the time. From the moment of his birth, this particular ragdoll was different. The rest of his family loved nothing more than to loll and doze in the sunshine, groom their soft fur, and be pampered by their humans. This kitten's eyes were always wide open and on the lookout. His fur was wild, sticking up in every direction, and when he walked, you could hear him coming from a mile away because unlike other cats who walk silently, this kitten walked with short, powerful steps that sounded like drum beats. While his brothers and sisters hung like wet noodles in their humans' arms, he was stiff as a board and ready for action. Because he was so unsteady on his little kitten paws, his mother and father named him Tippy. Tippy tried his best to fit in with the other rag dolls. He tried to hone his sleeping, relaxing, and grooming skills, but the quiet life of a ragdoll was way too boring for Tippy. He loved his family, but he was beginning to realize that he needed to find his own way in the world. One afternoon, when he was almost grown up, Tippy heard the most amazing sounds he had ever heard. All the other cats were asleep, as usual, so Tippy quietly left the house and followed the sound. He found himself sitting on the sidewalk outside a stadium where a rock band was playing. He climbed up onto the wall for a better view, and he was mesmerized. The music was as loud and as wild as Tippy's hair. The humans' clothes were just as wild as he felt. A blur of Tom jeans, bright bandanas, and eyeliner. It was the best thing he had ever seen. When the guitarist smashed his guitar to pieces at the end of the show, Tippy knew he had found his people. He waited outside next to the tour bus, and when the band came out and climbed in, Tippy followed right after them. He climbed right up on the lead singer's lap, looked him in the eye, and sneezed in his face. The singer, whose name was Steel Tulip, laughed and wiped himself off and said, "Man, this cat is rock and roll." And that's how Tippy joined a famous rock band called Blind Cheetah. Tippy toured the world with Blind Cheetah. His fur got bigger and bigger and wilder until he looked like a giant gray fur ball with legs. Slam, the guitarist, laid his electric guitar on the stage, and Tippy strutted back and forth across the strings, pulling on them with his sharp claws. Fans all over the world adored him. Tippy sent his parents postcards from all the places he went, Tokyo, New York, London, Hamburg. They didn't understand his life, but they could see that he was happy, so they were happy too. After a few years of touring, Tippy retired from the band and went to live with two other cats named Pumpkin and Gabriel and their humans, Aaron and Ezra. Pumpkin and Gabriel loved having Tippy around. Knocking things over continues to be one of Tippy's favorite activities. He climbs onto the kitchen counter and headbutts the cat food container down, and then they feast when the container breaks open against the floor. He's way more mellow now, but he still loves to tell stories about his days with the band. Whenever he hears a good rock song, his head starts bobbing and he starts dancing around, looking for things to knock over. Like every one of us, Tippy was born special and unique. He needed to find his own way in life, even if letting out his inner rock star sometimes made his parents worry. Tippy loves his mom and dad, but he didn't quite feel like himself until he grew up and left home. This is something we all have to do as we get older. You might have years and years to be home with your family before the time comes for you to go to college or join a rock band or take off for New Zealand. But when that time comes, you'll be ready. And no matter how far away you go, you will always be safe and loved. You'll always be welcomed back. When Tippy goes to visit his mom and dad, they always welcome him with loud purrs and affectionate nuzzling. If your time is now, then go. Have an adventure. Grow your hair wild and learn something about yourself that you never knew before. And if you ever see a miniature cat with bright tufts of gray fur sticking out here and there, as a yellow muscle car cruising by with tinted windows, awesome sound system blasts music that makes the whole neighborhood shake, don't worry. It's probably just Tippy being Tippy.
The service is never done because I don't complete it. You complete it by your own response. Your own reflection on what it might have to say in your life. And it certainly isn't done in the midst of it, as the Spirit is moving among us. And the Spirit just moved me to realize that the closing words really are the words for this moment. So they're from Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, from his text Self-Reliance, an essay he wrote in 1841. And so I invite you to let these words lead us into a time of silence, prayer, and meditation. Insist on yourself. Never imitate. Your own gift you can present every moment with the cumulative force of a whole life's cultivation. But of the adopted talent of another, you have only an extemporaneous half possession. Now, surrounded by the sounds of our community, we will keep a few moments of silence together. I'm sorry to share the news that a beloved, longtime member of our congregation, Olive Hobbs, has been diagnosed with cancer. Olive is at the nursing unit of the facility where she lives, and she welcomes your cards, and a couple of visitors at a time would be welcome too. John Broverone is continuing his recovery at a rehabilitation facility. I was able to visit him this week, and he asked that I extend to you his gratitude for all of the cards and thoughts and prayers in support of his return to health and wholeness. Christy Anderson is celebrating today the birth of her first grandchild this week. William arrived healthy, and the family is doing well. For all of these names that have been spoken and those that you hold in the sanctuary of your hearts, we give our grateful thanks. And will you join with me now in the spirit of prayer? Blessed Spirit of life and of love, of mystery and of wonder, it's easy to connect with your movement in our lives in moments of birth and death, when the defenses are down and our hearts are open. Help us to let the defenses down on the ordinary days, to keep our hearts open on the ordinary days, that we can feel the Spirit moving within us, notice it moving among us and beyond us, helping us connect to our highest aspirations and our deepest longings, and to notice those in the people we meet. O Spirit of life and of love, of mystery and of wonder, help us to let down the defenses, open our hearts, and live this moment as a precious gift. Amen, and blessed be.
On my father's side of the family, I was the first female to graduate from high school. My father was the first ever to accomplish this. In fact, most everyone on that side of my family quit school at an early age to work, have a family, or both. Education was something for rich folks, and we came from poor working class people. No one had ever considered higher education as an option for getting ahead. We just weren't a college-going family. During my senior year of high school, I watched as my boyfriend filled out college applications and was eventually accepted into Ohio State. I didn't bother with all of that, even though my high school guidance counselor told me that my grades were high enough to get into a good university. My boyfriend's mother, however, was quite convincing. She was generally not a likable woman, but I give her credit for being persistent. She really pushed me to apply, just to see. So I applied to Kent, the only school I had ever really wanted to attend. I was really astonished when I was accepted. My dream was short-lived, however. Since I was on my own financially, I couldn't pay the tuition and had to drop out in the middle of my first semester. Being a first-generation college student, I didn't know about loans and grants and scholarships or anything that would have helped me. I didn't even know such things existed. So I told myself that I had tried and it just wasn't meant to be, and that was that. For the next few years, I worked, got married, had two daughters, got divorced, and eventually found myself living on welfare in the refinished attic of my grandparents' farmhouse. In 1992, I met a nice man, got engaged, and moved with him to Athens, Ohio, where he was finishing his studies at Ohio University. I really loved it there. I was fascinated with the atmosphere of education and college life. And even though I was a young mother, an anomaly in Athens, I wanted to be part of all that learning happening around me. I applied to OU and began my college career in January of 1993. I cannot even begin to tell you how much I loved going to school. Honestly, it was the most amazing experience. I got straight A's in all of my classes, and everyone wanted to study with me. I felt like a rock star. I was older than everyone else. I was a mom. I was so different from them, but they liked me anyway. It was the first time in my life I felt like I truly fit in. My fiancé graduated in May of that year, and we moved back home. We decided to move in with my grandparents so that we could save some money to get our life started. Big mistake. I know many of you have heard me speak about how difficult a person my grandmother was for most of my life. This time period was one of the worst for her and me. When we came back from Athens, she was astounded that I was going to continue my schooling here. Perhaps astounded is putting it mildly. She was angry, hurtful, and downright evil to me. She thought that my going to school in Athens was to pass the time or as a hobby. She never thought I would continue. She resisted me every step of the way. She refused to watch my daughters when I needed to go to appointments for financial aid or advising. She complained if I was gone and not helping her with her housework. She talked behind my back to her friends. It was awful. But it didn't stop me. One day, things were particularly bad, and I asked her for what seemed like the millionth time, "Why do you care so much that I'm going to school? Why does it bother you this badly?" And her response was this: "Because you are belittling me. Children are not supposed to be better than their parents. You hate me." She went on to say that there was no need for me to get an education because I already had a man. I should just be happy staying home and taking care of him. I tried not to internalize these things, but that's easier said than done. It made me question my worthiness and motives, even though I knew I was doing the right thing, that I was setting a good example for my daughters, that I was bettering myself. This kind of argument went on for years until she eventually realized that I wasn't going to quit school and that I was actually quite good at what I was doing. When I completed graduate school and began working for Kent State teaching Spanish, she would introduce me to her friends as the little professor. Her hatred of what I had done turned into pride. It took me literally decades to understand why she made my life so difficult. First, I realized through counseling and my own research that she suffered with several, at times competing, mental and personality disorders. This alone could explain everything. But the most revealing reason came one day, about 5 years ago, out of the blue, when she said to me, "You know, I wish I had finished school. Maybe I wouldn't be so dumb. I could be smart like you." Her resistance had nothing to do with me and everything to do with her. I only wished I had learned this sooner. Our hymn of affirmation is number 184 in your gray hymnal, "Be Ye Lamps Unto Yourselves."
The words to that hymn are attributed to the Buddha, you may have noticed if you read down to the bottom of the page. And they're among the last words that he spoke to his followers before his death. He goes on after those words to elaborate the ways that a person can be a lamp unto themselves, specifically by working to free themselves from the cravings or desires that lead to suffering. So the words in that song have a very particular reference to the Buddhist pathway to liberation. And even though this service is not particularly focused on Buddhism today, I suggested we sing that song anyway because I've been in a conversation with Ralph Waldo Emerson all week, and I think he would have been drawn to those words had he heard them. And in fact, he may have well read them because Emerson was very interested in reading texts, Eastern texts from sacred traditions that were translated into English, and perhaps those were among those that he read. Had he encountered them and not known the meaning that the Buddha intended, I think Emerson would have resonated with those words nonetheless and drawn his own meaning in accord with his views about self-reliance. Now, that word self-reliance may be a little misleading because it sounds like a kind of do-it-yourself, I don't need anybody else connotation, and that's not exactly what he meant. His essay, Self-Reliance, which he wrote in 1841, was delivered at the height of his circuit writing lecturing career. He traveled all over delivering these lectures to people, and self-reliance was one of the most popular. At the time, he had already become well known for his transcendentalist views, and his primary aim in that message was to encourage people in accord with that transcendentalist sensibility that he had to live with fidelity to the unique spark of the divine in their own souls. That was his purpose in that essay. These are his words from that essay. He says, "What I must do is all that concerns me, not what the other people think. This rule, equally arduous in actual life and in intellectual life, may serve for the whole distinction between greatness and meanness. It is the harder because you will find those people who think they know what your duty is better than you do. It is easy in the world to live after the world's opinion. It is easy in solitude to live after our own. But the great person is the one who, in the midst of the crowd, keeps with perfect sweetness the independence of their solitude. Lori succeeded in that aspiration when she chose to follow her call to continue her studies despite the objections from an important person in her life. Emerson said, "There is always going to be someone who thinks that they know your duty better than you know it yourself. Thus, we must be devoted to protecting our own deep knowing from the pull of external pressures." One of the things that Emerson had to deal with in his circle was the pressure from his friends to join the Brook Farm Commune. The Transcendentalist friends of his started this commune as an experiment in living their vision of a just, wholesome, and integrated life, and they believed that Emerson was talking the talk, so they should come walk the walk and start Brook Farm with them. He would not be swayed. Though he did experiment with some of the ideas that they were advocating, including vegetarianism and balancing his intellectual work with manual labor. I can't find out whether or not the vegetarianism stuck for Emerson, but I know that the manual laborer did not, for he wrote in his journal, "The writer shall not dig." He concluded that it left him too tired for his scholarly work. In his personal life and in his writing, Emerson rejected conformity. He felt that people should find and nurture what is unique in their own minds and hearts. "Bid the invaders take their shoes from their feet," he wrote, "for God is here within." So that's what he meant by self-reliance. He meant finding the God within yourself and relying on the still small voice that you can hear within yourself if you take the time to listen. In another of his essays, Emerson complained of preachers who succumbed to conformity and just delivered the standard what you'd expect interpretation on the biblical text for that day, instead of interpreting it through the light of their own knowledge and experience of the divine. Emerson wanted people to notice and to honor the spark of the divine in themselves and to nurture their own relationship with the divine source. He wanted to encourage people to be their best and their truest selves. That's what he meant by self-reliance. My guess is that all of us could tell a story about a time when it was hard for us to be our best and truest selves. Sometimes the pressure to conform comes from particular individuals who we know by name. Other times the pressure just like comes from society in general. So one example that has been on my mind a lot in the past year is gender expression. Though significant progress has been made, there are still volumes of expectations about what it means to be a girl or a boy or a man or a woman in society. And there are still people who want to socialize little tiny beings into these ways of expressing gender. People whose experience deviate from those expectations often find that there is a price to pay for choosing to be themselves, and sometimes that price is quite steep. But I'm heartened by the fact that conversations about gender identity and expression are much more common now than they were even just a few years ago, and I'm hopeful that the next generation of trans and gender queer and any person who doesn't find themselves expressing a traditional gender identity in alignment with their biological gender will find that the world is more accepting as a result of all these changes. I'm hopeful. And if the commercials for Axe body spray is any indicator, there is a good reason to hope. So if you're not familiar, Axe is a personal care line of products owned by Unilever, and it's aimed at young men. The company puts a lot of commercials on the internet, which is where I encounter them when I'm trying to watch things online. Often, I'm greeted with an Axe commercial first. And their commercials tend to be highly sexualized, hyperly macho, and very narrow in an expression of what it means to be a man. I have no idea what's gotten into them, but apparently Axe is ready to explore some new dimensions of masculinity. So their most recent ad, shows lots of different kinds of men, gay men and straight men, and even cross-dressing men, doing lots of different kinds of things, not just driving in fast cars. The ad is posted on YouTube if you want to see it, and there's a little description underneath it that says, "Who needs a six-pack when you have your own thing? No must-have, must-be fashion norms or body standards. The most attractive man you can be is yourself. So find what makes you you, then work on it." It's like night and day from their previous ads. So could it be that someone with power in Unilever has been reading Emerson? I don't know. Whatever the reason for the change, I think a broader understanding of gender identity and expression is a good thing for people of all genders. It makes more room for people to be themselves. Emerson's essay is all about the importance of resisting the pressures of the world and claiming authenticity and wholeness in our own lives. Just as important, I think, is the need for resistance against the pressures of the world that inhibit other people from claiming authenticity and wholeness in their lives. And in this, I believe Emerson still had some room to grow. In his essay, he explains that he personally does not feel beholden to trying to alleviate the challenges of the poor, for they are not of his spiritual class. Basically, that's what he says. I'm personally grateful for the lasting influence of universalism on transcendentalism in general, and on Emerson's writings in particular. And I'm also grateful for the ways in which the theological claims of universalism have corrected the limitations of their views. The value of being your whole and holy self is not limited to those who are formally educated or spiritually skilled. In fact, those who are most disinherited are often among those most in need of help to nurture their own capacity to listen for the still small voice within themselves. And those who are most disinherited often face some of the highest levels of risk when striving to be authentic to their own heart's call and to live a path that isn't strictly mainstream. I use that word disinherited after Joseph Boyd, who is a Unitarian Universalist young adult seminarian. He's recently completed a year-long chaplaincy residency at Rikers Island Correctional Facility in New York. And he wrote an essay about his experience working as a chaplain there called The Disinherited. In it, he describes his relationship with a young man who's incarcerated there named Will. In the beginning, he tried to connect with Will, but Will clearly wanted to be invisible. But he persisted, and in time, Will finally introduced himself. And when he did, he introduced himself as a poet. Can you imagine the kind of courage it must take for a young man incarcerated in a prison like Rikers Island to introduce themselves as a poet? I can't. I can't imagine that kind of courage. But I believe that if prisons could provide the spiritual and therapeutic resources to help people who want to find their inner poet or their inner artist or their inner theologian, it would go a long way to making prison the kind of place that can really offer rehabilitation to people and not just punishment. Joseph Boyd writes in his essay, "Our universalist tradition claims something very radical. In a time of people desperate to prove their salvation, the universalists claimed salvation was a birthright, that you couldn't ever lose it, and that there was nothing you could do to earn it either. Simple idea, radical implementation. There's nothing you can do to get ahead in the game of salvation. There's no ultimate thing you can do to be disinherited from God's love." If we believe that, we cannot be just for ourselves alone. It's important for us to work on growing our own souls and cultivating our own capacity for authenticity and wholeness. That's part of why we're here. But just as important, we're in this world for each other, and so we must be for one another. Underneath the labels and the stereotypes, hidden behind the prison clothes and the work uniform, somewhere invisible in each and every life, even the most disinherited, there is something of the divine. The unique spark shines in each particular person in a unique way, and the still small voice calls to each particular person in a particular way. The work of growing our souls is learning to look for and to listen for the ways in which we are called to grow in wholeness and to do what we can to help create the kind of world where everyone else can do that work and grow into their own wholeness too. That is our calling. May we answer as faithfully as we can. Amen. Earlier this month, we took a special collection for the minister's discretionary fund and collected over $2,000 from members and friends of this congregation to help support other members and friends of this congregation in times when financial hardship strikes. It's just one of the ways that we as a community are generous with each other. And when we take our offering each week, we give of our generosity to help us hone and cultivate the ministries of this place, which are for us, yes, but also for everyone else for whom our circle extends. Because we take our mission out into the world, so we take something of our ministry out into the world every single week. If you are our guest this morning, we're glad that you are with us, and we welcome your contributions to this community even as we welcome you. The offering will now be gratefully received.
To carry to sleep, oh, word of
Our worship now ends. Let our service begin. The world needs your gifts. So go now and be a blessing. Amen.